Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio.
Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting.
Welcome to Faith Radio Mornings here on the 2nd of October. Glad to be on the air this morning. We didn't know it yesterday, but we had some significant engineering problems, and so we could not broadcast out of the studio. Thank you for the texts, the comments, just hoping that we are okay, that I didn't oversleep. I loved that comment as well. We are here. We did broadcast the show, but now we're coming out live to you here on this morning, and glad that you're listening as we start our day together, talking about the relevant news items and special interest topics with guests from around our country. And, you know, we're going to do that with a real faith and a genuine hope, and we can do that because we do know that that tomb is empty. And so we are part of a living kingdom with a living king that knows no end. And so as we bring our guests on these mornings, we won't do this from a Democratic or Republican standpoint, though our guests will have their opinions and their angles. We will stay anchored to the kingdom as we talk about the news and the topics. And I'm your host for the show, Dr. Peter Kapsner. Grateful to be joined in studio this morning by Rachel Sutton, who is running the sound and the board for us, and Paul Perot, who helps produce the show and keeps the news flowing all morning long. And of course, if you listen to the show, you know that I love it when you call or text the studio. We love your participation and your feedback and your opinions. And so if you want to join the show at some point this morning, you can call or text at 877-933-2484. That's 877-93-FAITH. Well, if you follow the news at all, you know there's lots to get to, and excited for our first hour ahead. Tommy Binion of the Heritage Foundation joins me as my Tuesday morning regular guest, and he brings a wonderful insider perspective from Washington, D.C., where he works with the executive branch on policy matters. So when we have Tommy in, he really is at that ground level and gives us that good firsthand perspective. So we'll talk with Tommy about some updates on the Supreme Court nomination process, as well as the trade agreement that was signed yesterday between the United States, Mexico, and Canada, something that kind of came down to the 11th hour, but it was signed, and now we will see what the implications are for that moving forward. And after Tommy, in the second half of this hour, Dr. Bruce Ashford will be joining us. He's a seminary dean and professor, and we'll talk with Bruce about how Christians can be separate from the political parties, but also engaging with them at the same time. And so Bruce will help us sort out our citizenship in heaven. He recently gave a talk on this that was picked up by C-SPAN. He had some pretty interesting questions and answers at that time. So Bruce is an excellent guest. I know you know his voice and brings a wonderful shared wisdom and perspective. But before bringing those two into the conversation, our thought for the week comes from the theologian N.T. Wright, who gives us some hope in the midst of a world that often seems dark. And he reminds us of who we are as believers, what our task is during our time on this earth, a world that is still waiting its final redemption. N.T. Wright says this, that if we're left to ourselves, we may end up with the general belief that things are getting worse and there's nothing we can do about it. But we are wrong. Our task in the present is to live as resurrection people in between Easter and that final day, with our Christian life, corporate and individual, worship and mission, as a sign of Easter and also as a foretaste of the world to come. So to all my sisters and brothers following Jesus out there, listening throughout our country, remember that first and foremost, we are citizens of heaven. So as you're getting to work this morning, grabbing your coffee, getting your kids out of bed, or busting out the crossword puzzle early on this morning, let's live today as people of the resurrection, as difficult as that might be at times, for there's no other hope in this world. And with that, we'll bring Tommy Binion into the conversation of the Heritage Foundation next on Faith Radio Mornings.
I'm just a bill, yes, I'm only a bill, and I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. Well, it's a long, long journey to the Capitol City.
And that Schoolhouse Rock song means that Tommy Binion from the Heritage Foundation is joining us. It's Tommy's music, and I love having Tommy on the program on Tuesday mornings to talk through some of the headlines from an insider Washington perspective. Tommy, I don't know what it's like this week, but I find myself getting up and checking the news and just cringing, wondering what could possibly be coming next. How are you processing everything?
by banging my head against the wall. It is a frustrating week. It really is. You know, it's disappointing. It's emotional. There's all kinds of stuff going on, but especially with the confirmation process of Judge Kavanaugh, you know, it feels like we've reached a new low. It feels like the partisan politics are at a new low. But at the same time, you know, confirming this great judge is just on the horizon. And so there is, I think, reason to be optimistic that potentially the FBI report will be done today. They could vote, you know, as early as Thursday or Friday of this week, and we could move on from this whole episode.
Well, it sure sounds like they are going to vote this week, Tommy. Senator McConnell came out yesterday and said there will be a vote, and I don't think that he would say something like that if he wasn't relatively confident about what's going to come out from the FBI investigation, if anything. Was some of this that Jeff Flake did last week, the senator from Arizona, in which he decided to, quote-unquote, side with the Democratic Party and call for the investigation, was he giving a little bit of political cover to some of his colleagues that maybe were a bit undecided?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I mean, I think what he was indicating is that Kavanaugh did not have the votes to get confirmed last week, that there were a handful of Republicans, and I would say that it's Jeff Flake, Lisa Murkowski, potentially Susan Collins, that were uncomfortable confirming them at the moment and would be made more comfortable by an FBI investigation. That's frustrating. That's disappointing. But at the end of the day, if the FBI investigation yields what we think it will yield, which is nothing, all that it cost us was a week. And the difference is, of course, the winning margin in terms of confirming Brett Kavanaugh. So, yes, it was a very frustrating moment. There's a lot of speculation that those votes weren't there. If those four votes materialize, and they do vote yes after this investigation concludes, then we can look back and we can say, well, all is well that ends well.
Well, I saw last night, and maybe this is part of a process where the delay tactics maybe have backfired, but I saw last night that Senator Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota, that the polls reveal that she's down now 10 points in the upcoming midterm election, and that the primary issue and the reason why she's down so much is because of her opposition to Kavanaugh. And so this might put quite a bit of pressure on her to turn around and vote, where maybe she didn't have that same pressure last week given the polls.
Yeah, I think the political implications of this process are becoming more and more clear by the day. Of course, this time of year in the election cycle, we get a poll back almost every single day. And those polls that are coming back are showing that voters do not like how the Democrats have handled this confirmation process. They think that Kavanaugh is a qualified judge. Now, of course, they're very polarized. People have gone to their polls. The Democrats, their base, they love what they've done. But I think, by and large, people are not pleased with the scenes they see playing out on their TV screen. North Dakota is no exception. I find it hard to believe that Senator Heitkamp didn't know that. You know, these senators that are running for reelection, they really have their finger on the pulse of their states because they so desperately want to get reelected. She must have felt that on some level that Kavanaugh was popular in her state even before this poll came back.
And I think what's difficult for people to watch, too, just as you're referencing the Democratic Party in this situation, and this could happen to either party, actually, is that it can become a bit what seems to be outside looking in, a little hypocritical or sanctimonious. And so you see this impassioned defense for women, and women in our country have to be defended. I think we can all say and agree upon that the way women have been treated in our country has really just been rubbish over the last 30, 40, 50 years, if not since the founding of the country. So we have a legitimate conversation to have. But I think what people struggle with is it's tough to swallow somebody like Cory Booker, you know, standing on the side of women and being so sanctimonious in his conversations and questioning of Kavanaugh, when we know his past, that he celebrated himself publicly as one who managed to succeed in groping a woman. And I just think that's what gets hard in this process, Tommy.
I think absolutely. There is there's a lot of hypocrisy. There's a guy running for Senate in Texas, Beto O'Rourke, that wrote some things about women's appearances in review of a play. And of course, he's also hypocritical and sanctimonious about this. And you're right to point out that women have been treated poorly in this country. But I don't think that's unique to America. I think one of the things the Democrats want us to do is to be ashamed of our own country, to be ashamed of the United States of America. And I'm proud of the United States of America, and I'm proud of some of the advancements, particularly that have come for women in this country and this country alone. I think that's something to be celebrated. We don't always get that from our leaders and our senators. Instead, we get the tearing down. And I think that's really been on display this week, and that's why we're all so glum about this process.
Well, the president certainly has put the Democratic Party on the defensive with his sort of consistent 20-month message, and even before that in the election cycle around Make America Great Again and this patriotism. He's really put the Democratic Party on the defensive that they should be patriotic too, and it seems like too often they are saying all of what's wrong with America, and that's something that doesn't necessarily resonate with the average voter.
Well, I think absolutely. Their message is part of a political strategy, though. If you don't like the United States the way it is, then it needs to be radically changed. And if you want it to be radically changed, you need to elect the Democrats. Of course, you know, the president's message when he ran in 2016, Make America Great Again, it harkens back to what America is at its core, what it has always been. Two fundamentally different political tones that are they're overt, right? Either America is great or it's terrible. But there's another sense in which they're subconscious a little bit. Either you want radical change in this country or you don't. And the choice between the parties is made clear in that way. I think most Americans at their core are fundamentally patriotic. I think they're fed up with politics, that's for sure. But I think in terms of pride in this country, I think they have a lot of it. And that's one of the reasons that Donald Trump is president, is he tapped into that.
We had a quote last night from the president's rally in Tennessee that we played that speaks to this issue in terms of what feels like such a deconstructive effort by the Democratic Party.
Democrats are willing to do anything and to hurt anyone to get their way, like they're doing with Judge Kavanaugh.
I think, Tommy, that's what people are, again, beginning to resist more and more, is that I think you can make a healthy critique of something that's constructive and say we really want it better, as opposed to this slash and burn kind of idea. And it seems like when people are not in power, they become ready to slash and burn. I even remember the Tea Party and when the Republican Party was in the minority, they did a lot of slash and burning back then, too. And it seems like now it's that on steroids.
Well, one of the tactics the Democrats have used this year in particular is to raise the stakes of what is important in a Supreme Court nomination, for instance. So some of the rhetoric coming out from the Democrats in the early part of this process was that lives were at stake, that people would die, that a Trump nominee to the Supreme Court could potentially be responsible for people's deaths. When you make life and death at stake, even if it's just rhetoric, people are going to take that seriously. You know, there have been literally countless death threats flowing into the Capitol this last month to various senators that are involved with this process. The violent rhetoric, the life and death stakes, that doesn't feel like America to me. We're much more stable than that. Whether you agree with Brett Kavanaugh or not, one Supreme Court nominee, one Supreme Court justice is not going to fundamentally change the character of our country. And it was the same after the election. When Hillary lost, it was the end of the world. That was the reaction we got from the Democrats. And in turn, we got the resist movement. Because if the stakes are really that high, that makes sense to react that way. That has been their tactic over the last 2 years. If it works for them, we'll find out in November. If it works for them, we can expect it to continue.
It's Tommy Binion of the Heritage Foundation giving us some insider perspective as he works with the executive branch in Washington, D.C. Tommy, when we come back from break, I'd like to change the conversation and get into some of what happened with the trade agreement yesterday, where I was watching a little bit of CNN, and they said that the president had another victory economically. And when CNN extols the president, it really gets my attention. So we'll talk about that next with Tommy Binion on Faith Radio Mornings. about 22 minutes past the hour. I'm joined by Tommy Binion, my friend from the Heritage Foundation out of Washington, D.C. And, Tommy, before getting back into some of the more serious news items, I see that we have some birthdays today among celebrities. We've got singer-songwriter Don McLean. He's 73 years old, best known for his classic song, American Pie. And we have the singer Sting, obviously, from The Police. If you had to turn on some music right now, Tommy, would you roll with Sting or would you roll with American Pie?
I guess I'd roll with Sting. If I had to. Happy birthday, Sting. You win the contest.
I love it. that means that Rachel Sutton will find a good Sting song here that we'll come out of break with in just a minute. But more headlines to come out of Washington, D.C., including the trade agreement. I know that NAFTA, which has been the trade agreement between the United States and Canada and Mexico, has been a source of contention for the president. And I did see some headlines coming out of CNN yesterday that said that the president won a significant victory. I was a little surprised by that, and it got my attention, so I delved a little more deeply into it. But what happened in these last 24, 48 hours in that agreement, Tommy?
Well, so let's back up a little bit. Trump has been trying to renegotiate NAFTA, the free trade agreement between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. He has been trying to renegotiate it. This was a central feature of his campaign. He ran. He hates NAFTA, always has. It's been part of his rhetoric for two decades now, and he has been renegotiating it. Some 6 or 8 weeks ago, it was announced that the U.S. and Mexico had come to an agreement, but Canada had not yet entered into the agreement. Last week in New York at the UN, the president, he even said publicly to the press that he rejected a meeting with Justin Trudeau and that the two sides between the U.S. and Canada in terms of negotiating this were not close. They didn't like each other's negotiating style. They weren't getting along. It was a very pessimistic view. And then late Sunday night, I think it was actually 10 o'clock at night or later, there was a conference call where, and this was the very last few hours before the deadline, there was a conference call where Canada came into the agreement. So we woke up Monday morning to the good news that all three parties, U.S., Mexico, and Canada, had agreed to a new trade agreement. It had a new name, the USMCA. I'm not sure there's a way to make that into a word like NAFTA or CORUS, but the USMCA is the new free trade agreement, or trade agreement as it were. We're going to see the reaction to this. There's some first blush reactions. Some of the big ticket items are rules for auto manufacturing and rules for dairy exports into Canada. Those things are getting a lot of attention, but just about every industry will be touched by this, and there's some really detailed, complicated analysis going on by it. But the first victory is that all three parties are on board. In other words, that's almost a validation of the president's negotiating style. He played hardball, and he refused a meeting with Trudeau, and he said he would go with just Canada. This is not the kind of hardball rhetoric we normally see from U.S. presidents, maybe from businessmen in the boardroom, but not necessarily in the White House. And here we have Trump employing it and having success with it. This is the payoff for the Trump presidency. Very interesting.
It is really interesting to watch. I'll say I own a business as well, and I'm mindful when I go into conversations with people that there better be some leverage that I have and a willingness to walk away from the table, or else you do just sort of cave and acquiesce. And the president has definitely a history in the last 20 months of walking away from the table, whether it's the nuclear negotiations with North Korea, whether it's China and the tariffs. And so it does then increasingly seem like it'll put pressure on future negotiations because people know he has a history of walking away. That feels relatively new in some of the American negotiations the last maybe a couple presidents.
It is definitely new. And every American who's ever bought a car or any sort of negotiation knows what you just pointed out, which is you've got to be willing to walk away. It's a basic principle of negotiation. This is what the American people wanted, though. You know, before the partisan politics and before the rhetoric and before Twitter, President Trump was the guy who wrote The Art of the Deal. He was the host of The Apprentice. He was the one who sold the American people on the idea of a businessman president. This is that. This is what they wanted. Certainly, it's played out in other contexts, potentially North Korea, the Iran nuclear deal, all sorts of other things. But now that we're on the other side of it and it has worked and world leaders have come back to the table and given the president what he wanted, it's a whole new thing. And it's a really great storyline, I think, from the Trump presidency.
Well, it certainly is consistent with an ongoing economic boom in our country, what we see happening there. Tommy, I really appreciate you coming on with me on Tuesday mornings like this to just talk about some of the issues and the headlines coming out of Washington, D.C.
You bet. Can't wait to hear the sting.
It's coming right now, Tommy. Have a great week.
Bye-bye.
Well, for our friends in Wisconsin who might be baseball fans, great news yesterday that there is a one-game divisional playoff to see who would go on to get a bye in the first round and who would have to play a play-in game. And the Milwaukee Brewers came out victorious over the Chicago Cubs yesterday following a tense 3-1 victory at Wrigley Field. National League Division Series begins Thursday at Miller Park, so rest for a few days and your Milwaukee Brewers will be back at it. See if they can take the journey all the way to the World Series. We'll have Bruce Ashford up next here on Faith Radio Mornings, and we're going to talk about what it means to be a believer who does have an allegiance first to the kingdom of heaven, but then will also participate in the political parties. Bruce is on C-SPAN this last week. It should be a good conversation coming up with him on Faith Radio Mornings. Yesterday on Faith Radio Mornings, I was joined by Brandon Schulwalter of the Christian Post, and he was talking us through the persecution that's happening in Egypt among Coptic Christians.
Well, the Coptic Christians have been through suffering that we have not fully appreciated. In Egypt especially, they have known what it is like to suffer for Christ in a way that few in the West have. And yes, they are being considered for the Nobel Peace Prize. So much of biblical history is born out of Egypt. You know, Jesus, we know the story of how he escaped Herod's wrath going to Egypt. Yes, the Coptics are being nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, I think, for their witness, for their peaceful witness. All your listeners need to read up on what the Copts have endured in the last decade, really, because they have been targeted many, many times. And yet they're about approximately, if I'm not mistaken, about 10% of the Egyptian population. They are a strong people who love the Lord, and they know what it means to suffer for Christ.
Love having Brandon Schulwalter of the Christian Post on every Monday morning. He does such a great job covering the news from a Christian standpoint. So you can head to myfaithradio.com or check it out on our Facebook page for Faith Radio and see some of the comments that Brandon had in that entire segment. Well, I see my friend Bruce Ashford is on the line already, and we're going to talk a bit about how Christians can get involved in politics in a secular age. So it should be a great conversation with Bruce next on Faith Radio Mornings.
God's view of ethnicity doesn't involve race, but whether or not a person knows him. This is Jim Garlow. God's view should be our view. In fact, God tells us to help everyone come to know him so that the result will be what was reported by the Apostle John in Revelation chapter 7, verse 9. I looked and behold a great multitude that no one could number from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes, with palm branches in their hands. From God's perspective, there's only one race, the human race. There are definitely different cultures, and often there's ethnic strife between them, which breaks the heart of God. The cry of our hearts should be that the human race become one great family as God intended. It's an issue we must address sooner rather than later. This is Jim Garlow.
Of course, that Welcome to the Jungle music means that Bruce Ashford is joining me. He's a dean and he's a professor. He talks a lot about culture, theology, all coming together. And he has his website, BruceAshford.net, that I know I try to draw you as listeners to, because he does such a great job just thinking through our engagement in our society from a Christian standpoint. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning. It's great to be back on the show. Thank you.
We love having you, and I know that you have been engaged specifically very recently on some of this idea of how we as citizens can, of heaven can participate in the American political scene. And I appreciate that, Bruce, because every week on Faith Radio Mornings, I tend to get some emails from some listeners that will say that the show is far too liberal, and then I will get emails from other listeners that say the show is far too conservative. And I love that because maybe it we're walking sort of the middle ground of not being a part of either party but still participating in both.
Yeah, you know, I think if the first team that we play for is Christianity, and anything else is a second, third, or fourth team, like a political party, we're going to often find ourselves not having a bit of a critical distance. So nothing wrong at all with being involved in party politics and being a member of a party, but it always comes secondary, I think, to our Christian commitments. And if we can do that as Christians, maintain our first allegiance to Christianity so that we can have a healthy critical distance from worldly parties and allegiances, we have a chance to make Christianity interesting again.
Well, and it's so important, too.
Instead of being viewed as the hypocritical and bigoted special interest arm of, one or the other political parties.
Yeah, no, well said, Bruce. I think so often Christianity is perceived of that because it does have a specific alignment, and to sort of unwed ourselves, at least from an allegiance standpoint, to a political party is really helpful, and it's part of what you have been exploring recently. You were part of the Commonwealth Project. They invited you to speak at a conference, Christian Politics in a Secular Age. And it's a really interesting, captivating headline, Bruce, because I know a lot of people would suggest that America is a Christian country. There's always been Christianity associated with America. But I think what sociologists are finding these days is that there's an increasing secularization going on in our country. People aren't going to church as often. People aren't as interested in the faith. And so I'd love for you to just talk our listeners through a little bit of what it means that we're becoming more and more of a secular age.
Yeah, so what does it mean to be in a secular context, a secular age? I want to explore two thinkers, all right? If you're out there in radio land, I'm going to explain two books to you that you don't want to read. They'll give you a massive migraine if you read them. and one of them is the size of a cinder block. And, if you read it in bed, I'd be afraid that you would doze off and be crushed to death mid-sentence. So, but the books are very important, and they explain the context that we live in. So the first is a book written by a Jewish sociologist named Philip Reif. He was kind of a centrist. He wasn't really located entirely on the left or entirely on the right. And towards the end of his life, he published a trilogy, and the first book of that trilogy is called My Life Among the Death Works. And here's what he meant by that title. He said, listen, the West in general, and America in particular, is in the midst of a historically unprecedented attempt to sever religion from society. And he said, listen, all civilizations everywhere in history have understood that religion does and should shape society, and the way that it shapes society is that religion shapes cultural institutions and cultural products, right? It shapes legal institutions, marriages and families, churches, businesses, and then those sort of institutions or cultural products like books, movies, and so forth, that those things then in turn shape society, they shape people. But Reif said in the West, what many of our cultural power brokers have done, and he calls the cultural power brokers the officer class, that they condescend to the rest of us who are privates and try to order us around, that many of the cultural power brokers have tried to rip sacred order out from underneath social order, leaving social order to float on its own. In other words, that's fancy language for saying they've tried to remove any influence, real influence of historic Christianity on our cultural institutions and on the cultural products that shape us. And here's where the title comes in, My Life Among the Death Works. He said, now that that is happening, now that the influence of religion is being, sort of removed, that our cultural institutions and products become death works. Instead of bringing life and vitality to society, they bring death and decay. So I think that's a really powerful, and he explores the arts, he explores legal institutions, families, and shows how this is the case. Now there's a second thinker. So the first thinker was Philip Reif. He was a Jewish sociologist, American Jewish sociologist. The second thinker is a Canadian philosopher named Charles Taylor. Now, he's not, Peter, the same guy who made the Chuck Taylors, all right?
I was just checking out my shoes, Bruce. Anyway. I was excited there for a minute.
who knew? The guy that made the shoes is such a brilliant philosopher. So Charles Taylor wrote a book called A Secular Age, and it's a cinder block of a book. It's a big one. And In it, he argues that Westerners have learned, especially over the past 50 years, to live life, to manage life, without any real reference to anything outside of this world. So we might say we believe in God, we might go to church regularly, but still we're kind of secular in the sense that we don't really expect God to interact with us, to do anything that a God would do. And we manage life just without reference to him. And he said what's happened is that Christianity has been displaced from the default position, and not only is Christianity not the kind of most influential ideology or religion or whatever in the world, it's that Christianity is contested by dozens and dozens and dozens of other ideologies, and the result, he says, is that everybody, or almost everybody, you know, in the West has a hard time really believing what we say we believe. Atheists have a hard time really believing what they say they believe. Christians have a hard time with it. But everybody's belief system is kind of fragile. He uses that word, fragilized. So, you know, I think the question we want to ask, and you ask this question, I think, on the show implicitly all the time, is given this context, given that many people think historic Christian teaching is implausible, even unimaginable, you know, how could you possibly believe that? Given that that's the case, and given that even Christians have a hard time defending what they believe, or sometimes even a hard time believing what we say we believe, how can we be a public witness? I mean, isn't that the question?
It really is. Yeah, it really is a question, Bruce. And I know you've got some points on that. I would love to, after the break in just a minute, get to some of those specifics on that. I'd be curious just to back up for a second and get your thoughts. How much of this is a result of sort of the ongoing natural globalization that's been happening? And so people have been confronted with a lot of different value systems, a lot of different religious systems. It makes it difficult in this age of sort of relativism or individualism to really have sort of this macro values of Christianity affect our institutions when the people of the institutions themselves maybe are coming from lots of different faith perspectives or no faith perspective at all.
Yeah, great point. I was actually teaching, I teach a 3-hour course to undergrad students, 18-year-olds, that traces the rise and development of Western intellectual history. And just yesterday, we were pointing out how globalization has, it means not only that the world is hyper-connected, but that we are hyper-aware of our hyper-connectedness.
Mm.
I mean, every day we are rubbing elbows with people who believe very differently than us, and sometimes we don't rub elbows with anyone who believes the same as us. And you're exactly right that this can lead to a kind of a discomfort and a disorientation, that we're confused. We wonder if anything at all can be believed. And in that sort of a situation, in America, I think what's ended up happening is instead of being able to reason with each other, we just shout each other down. We just stand in the public square sweating and yelling and cursing, and it's kind of the dumpster fire moment that we're in right now.
It's Bruce Ashford. You can read his material at BruceAshford.net. Highly recommend going there as he helps us sort through sort of this middle way of being believers and still being engaged with our country. Bruce, when we come back from break, let's get into some of those strategies that you outlined in your talk around how we as Christians can get involved with politics in a secular age. So more to come with Bruce Ashford next on Faith Radio Mornings. It's about 11 minutes before the top of the hour here on Faith Radio Mornings, and love the conversations with Bruce Ashford. He writes for his website, BruceAshford.net, and you can find him all over the internet writing things about Christianity and the common good and how we as believers can participate in our world. And Bruce, as part of this talk that you gave here recently, and after you outlined sort of the sociology of this secular age, you did get in some tips about how we as believers can engage in politics. We certainly have time for a couple of those this morning. What would you suggest, at least as a starting point?
Yeah, you know, I think that the question is, when we find ourselves in a secular age, sometimes we're tempted to lose heart, right, and
yeah,
just sort of withdraw and quit, or on the other hand, charge into some sort of panic politics where we're just sort of yelling at people and trying to beat them around the head. But I think there's a better, you know, there's a better way than that. And just in broad contours, the first thing we need to do is we need to find creative ways to recenter God, to like reintroduce the idea of God into the public imagination, to help people, you know, begin to consider, hey, maybe there really is a God who interacts with his people and whose law transcends this world, that there is right and wrong, and that there is a God. Creative ways to do it. And I think, and I'll just give one example since we don't have a lot of time. One example is this. We in the way we talk about public issues, people need to have a clear understanding that we think the Bible story of the world is the true story of the whole world, and that we don't think that the MSNBC's narrative or CNN's or Fox's narrative is true story of the whole world. And the problem we've got today is that so many Americans have sat in their homes for hours and hours and hours and listened to secular radio hosts and secular political commentators on TV disciple them, fill their minds. And every media outlet has a story of the world in which there are certain evils. You know, for one of them, it's democratic socialism is the worst evil that could possibly happen in the entire world. And for another TV outlet, it is, you know, conservative evangelicals, the worst thing that could possibly happen to anyone in the world, you know. And then they'll have a messiah, a solution. Well, if you don't want the worst thing to happen, here's what you do. And we've been discipled by these outlets. And so as Christians, we need to help bring God back into the picture, all right? I think the second thing we need to do is if we're going to recenter God, we have to decenter ourselves. You know, God can't get the spotlight if we're hogging all the spotlight on ourselves. How do we decenter the self? Well, it's an other-centered ethic that Jesus taught. We do things for other people. We seek the good of the whole city. We serve other people. We need to be at the front of the line to do things that contribute to the common good of our nation. A third thing that we need to do is we need to learn how to reframe the public issues today, the hot-button issues that are so disputed, that people are so furious about. And instead of always couching everything the same way the secular left and the secular right do, because a lot of the thought on both sides of the aisle is put in secular categories, we need to reframe those issues in light of Christianity's distinctive teachings, and it can make us interesting again. You know, so often we're just kind of a boring part of the nasty political feuds of our day because we fit so seamlessly and easily onto one side or the other. So we want to reframe issues. And then finally, we want to revitalize our nation's cultural institutions that Christians, we ought to enter into to the best of our ability as God's given us the competence to do so, to enter into schools and families and businesses, legal institutions, military, police, institutions, and to find what's been twisted by sin and to help untwist it, to make things more just and good and right. And these are big 30,000-foot level things that I'm saying here, but everyone out there in radio land, listen, you have a way that you can do this. You have ways that you can act. You can begin speaking a good word into a bad situation on your Facebook discussions, your coffee shop conversations, the job that you work in, your family, your church. You know, all of us have a role to play. Does that make sense?
It really does. And I think, to your point, one just real practical tip, and I loved how you said this over the past couple of months, Bruce, that really caught my attention, is who are we being discipled by? And I find that if I'm not careful, those news outlets that I tend to trend towards will disciple me, meaning that they will create in me a way to think. They will create the kind of character that I have. I mean, to be a disciple of Jesus means that increasingly you're thinking and seeing the world like Jesus would and developing the character and the authority of Jesus. And certainly I think many of us have been discipled by the news outlets that we watch.
Yeah, echo chambers is the phrase that's often used. I think it's a good one, where we sit in a room with our favorite 9 o'clock p.m. or 10 o'clock p.m. you know, talk show host, and during the afternoons it's our favorite secular radio host. We just sit there for hours while they fill our head telling us exactly how to think about the issues of our day, and then we just take whatever's handed to us on the platter and don't even recognize it. Then we tend to conflate what we learned from these secular talk show hosts. We conflate it with Christianity. And in the end, that's really toxic. We got to find a better way of doing this. And let me suggest out in radio land, one of the best ways to do this is to listen to some reasonable, you know, Christian talk show hosts, which like this radio show, and to read some books that are written by people who, for whom Christianity is the first team and a political party is the second team. Right. So these are some of the things we can do.
And I think to the extent that maybe we can just stay engaged with the scriptures and have our worldview informed by what we see in the text, that does help us then as we're navigating situations in this world.
Yeah, there's a great British missiologist named Leslie Newbegin. He's a man named Leslie, and one of my favorite writers. And he always talked about, he said, soak yourself in the scriptures. Mm. And I think that's a good, it's a good sort of metaphor, if you will. Soak yourself in the scriptures. You know the Bible so well that it intuitively frames the way you view issues and informs our disposition and demeanor, so that we're not going to be tempted to act like a secular person might act, that we actually always have this Jesus-like combination of truth and love, or truth and grace.
Well, Bruce, we really appreciate you joining us, as you do so regularly here on Faith Radio Mornings, with just that perspective. Tell our listeners where they can go to watch this talk that you gave, Christian Politics in a Secular Age. I know, again, it was picked up by C-SPAN as well. Where can they go to access this information?
You know, the easiest way to access it is to go to BruceAshford.net, and I link to the C-SPAN page so you can watch the entire C-SPAN program. It's a 45-minute talk and then 30 minutes of Q&A. So if you go to my page, BruceAshford.net, you can access it there. And then my most recent book, Letters to an American Christian, is where I try to coach us on how to bring our Christianity into a secular public square. Thank you so much for having me on the show. This is the best radio program in the world.
Bruce, I love it. Thank you for that. That flattery will always get you invited back. Have a great week, Bruce. Really appreciate the time.
Okay, thanks. Great to be on the show.
We'll take a break here and wrap up our first hour of the show. So appreciated that first hour of the show with Tommy Binion from Washington, D.C., giving us an insider perspective on the events that are happening with the Supreme Court. And, of course, good friend Bruce Ashford, who joins us so regularly. His work is found all over the country, and just love his perspective that seems so balanced and fair. And, of course, anybody who says this is the best radio show in the land, he's coming back. Just need to know that everybody in studio just begins to shake their head, because they know I'm going to walk around and quote that all day long. Paul Perreault is really shaking his head right now. Well, we look forward to next hour. We're going to be joined first by Dr. Ann Bradley, and we're going to talk about capitalism and economics and some of what we see in our country with these new trade agreements. So lots more to come on Faith Radio Mornings.
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.